Welcome to Sunday Civics, the home for the civically engaged. I'm your host and civics teacher, L. Joy Williams. And on today's show, we're going to discuss what you do after you lose. The primary election season is officially over, and there are maybe some of you listening who were candidates during this cycle, or you worked or volunteered on a campaign that is now over, and you're thinking, what do I do next? And was it all worth it? And I'm going to share with you my experience with working for candidates and campaigns that come up short and what to do after you lose. But first, I don't do the show alone, or at least I try not to. I got my Thoroughest girls with me, as usual. My right hand, the best assistant ever. I take her everywhere. If you hire me to do something, I'm probably bringing her along. Yes. June like the month, Moses like the bottle.
That was the best.
Okay, can I tell you?
Because I would like a bottle.
Because there were multiple bottles had over the last couple of months.
Listen.
June like the month, Moses like the Bible. But listen, there are bottles in the Bible because...
They were lambskins
or something, I guess, is what they kept it in.
He took it from water to wine or whatever happened there.
But he carried in, they didn't carry it in bottles, I guess. Did they have lambskins or
something?
Listen,
I'm going to leave skins and lamb and all that other stuff alone. I'm not even going to touch it on this godly morning. I'm not even going to do it. Don't send emails.
But it also tells you where my mind is, and I was like, the bottle. Oh my goodness. Also with us, our social justice lawyer.
Hi. Hey, lawyer.
Laree Daniel Favors. I got her name right.
Hey, y'all.
All right.
Are you feeling do you need a bottle as well?
I feel like a healthy adulthood has a bottle accompanying it at various points.
Yeah.
I'm going to leave it there.
You're going to leave it there?
On this blessed Sunday morning. Hit me again come Sunday evening for dinner.
I mean, brunch happens.
It does.
And there's maybe you have a bottle of, champagne.
I thought you were going to say a bottle of mimosas. not quite, but
no.
Many, many glasses of unlimited.
A bottle of champagne of that makes up the mimosas.
Yes. Yes.
And then June and I and some members of my team that have been working hard over the past couple of months, we're going to Rose Mansion. This is not an endorsement of Rose Mansion or like we have some kind of endorsement deal. But just know I like Rose. And there is a mansion that has decked out and they have many rooms of Rose. And that is how we'll be celebrating the end of this primary season.
Yay. I think that's wonderful.
Yeah.
I fully support everything about that.
Yay.
I support me coming on said trip, though. I did not all the work I was doing, I was, in the back pumping a fist, and I think
you should have an invitation to the Rose Mansion blowout.
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
We'll have to extend the invitation to a few more folks.
Yeah, broaden Wakanda.
Broaden out the office a little bit,
include
some peripheral folks, to come and join us in the end, not of election season because there's still November to go,
right.
But
yes.
It is the end of the primary season. The New York State was our very last.
Yeah.
In terms of the election season. Look, some people had primaries way back in May.
That's right.
In June, they've had designated candidates for, primaries or things for some time. And there are a couple of states that have late primaries and we are one. And then you have, after you win the primary season, you then have like a month and some change to run a general election for those races. But so our election this past Thursday was the official end of primary season of all of these elections. And we're celebrating with Rosé.
I love
it. I'm all right with that.
So that's how we'll be celebrating. And that is probably why, June, I had the flip up of the
That's what we thinking about.
Bottle.
So it's all good. It's all good.
I apologize.
It's fine. I'll answer to that.
Yuck. June like the month, Moses like the bottles.
L. Joy Williams, political strategist.
I fight for what's right.
Be it day or night.
Sometimes.
Oh, well.
Oh, my goodness. Before we get to the civic docket, I'm going to flip this around a little bit. I don't know if you guys know this, but I read an awful lot.
I think this is why we're like sister friends.
I read a lot. I read news in the morning, which those of you who follow me on Twitter may see some of the news that I tweet, because I actually don't tweet everything that I read. I tweet things that I want. Hey, you should read this. Like, you know, like that is the thought that comes in my head. I read, you know, bad stuff, good stuff, and things of that nature. But I also read a lot of books. I have a lot of books. My husband has a joke where he says it's all fun and games to marry Belle until you have to move her.
Oh, he was thinking about all those books that had to be moved. He wanted to go all Fahrenheit 451 and just burn them, be like, enough, I'm not carrying this. What in the world?
As someone who observed said move, I must say, and I have moved, I was an army brat, so I have moved like every other year. We was packing up, moving. I must say that the idea of moving your physical library, that was intense. And it was doubly so because I believe he really did think he was going to get this move done in a day.
He was trying to get it done in a day.
He did. He was efforting.
He was very helpful.
He was very efforting.
Oh, my goodness.
He believed.
Oh, wow. An effort made in spirit and in strength. And it was not done.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's what he started with. The first thing he packed up was my library. And I have just over 400 books or so. Yeah. And so kudos to my husband for marrying Belle and moving her books. But introducing a new segment this fall on what I'm reading, because in addition to the news that I consume on a daily basis, I read a lot of magazine articles, long form reading, which, you know, by the way, you may find yourself, if you're reading things for a long period of time and you haven't in a while, that you're out of practice and you kind of get fidgety, you know, when you go past page 3 and you're like, this is not 200 words, because that's the standard now that is happening, like in people reading blog posts and things like that. They want 250 words, 500 words is too much. And, you know, I recently had to write something that was 1,800 words, and that took a lot.
Yeah.
But
650, she's still going?
Yes. But I'm introducing this new segment in terms of what I'm reading, because I'd like to share that it's not just the news, but there are other things. There are other books. There are other long form magazine articles or papers even. Mm. And shout out to you professors who are writing papers and thinking nobody's reading them. I read them. I read them. I read your research. And so during this segment, I want to share some of the things that I'm reading. And so first up, I went to the bookstore leisurely, not specifically for something, and was able to pick up this book that I just started reading. I'm only in a couple of pages, by someone I actually know, Janet Duart Bell. Has written a new book. It's called Lighting the Fires of Freedom, African-American Women in the Civil Rights Movement. And the book is about it shines a light on women of the Civil Rights Movement, which, you know, we talk about a lot, and you may hear people talking about a lot, because they were overlooked in the celebration and the sort of achievements of that era.
Yeah.
Right. You have individuals, and even still, the women that we have lifted up have been like Rosa Parks and, you know, others, and they're almost sainthood, right? Yeah. Reach and sort of out of reach. But there were regular everyday, you know, women, not to say that Rosa Parks wasn't a regular everyday woman, but there were so many other women involved in the movement and who were the backbone of the movement. And so in this book, they are testimonies from women who are now, some of them in their 90s, with these untold stories about the civil rights movement and sort of how their extraordinary struggles contributed to the profound social change that we had during that era. And Janet Bell is a communication strategist. She's a social justice advocate, an activist, and a coach, a motivational speaker. And she actually has a doctorate in leadership and change from Antioch University.
Wow.
And so this is a really good book. If you are thinking about picking up something, you're looking for something to read, it's not that long either, something that you can read relatively quickly. But this segment is also brought to you by Audible, which is a sponsor of Sunday Civics, and it's actually also in audiobook form. So you can go to sundaycivics.org/audible and get a free 30-day trial of Audible, and then get the book for free and listen to these stories.
I love it.
Laurie, you know Janet Bell.
Yeah, I came to know her through actually her late husband, Professor Derek Bell, was one of my law professors at NYU, a brilliant civil rights activist. I mean, they are like a power couple. And may he rest in peace. And so came to know her through his work and through the work that he had been doing just vis-a-vis the civil rights, his engagement as a professor. And so they are two of our elders. He now passed on, but she is certainly one of the elders who is holding and lighting a path for us to look backwards so that we can take a lot of them. Because those women, they were doing work that even aside from it not being credited, wasn't even necessarily understood in the calculus of how things got done. And were it not for the work that they were doing, a lot of those achievements that we laud today would not happen, similar to what we see often in a lot of religious institutions where the women do the work, the men get on the pulpit. So it's that type of thing. And so I'm so happy she was able to put this out. The Center for Law and Social Justice was one of the co-sponsors for the event that she recently held in Brooklyn with the Center for Black Literature. And we were just so proud to be affiliated with her work and the legacy that she describes in the book. So I'm excited that this is the first one on the list. Yay.
Well, pick it up. It's Lighting the Fires of Freedom, African-American Women in the Civil Rights Movement by Janet Bell. You can also go to sundaycivics.org/audible. That's AUDIBLE. And get a free 30-day trial of audiobooks from Audible. And you can pick up this book as your first free pick. So, that's what I'm reading.
Yay.
So moving on to our civic docket. There's a couple of things to discuss here. Mm-hmm. As you know, people feel like the world is, burning down.
It's not.
It is.
I just wanted clarity. If it's not, because I need to know.
It's a slow burn down.
I was watching one of the cable news morning shows this morning, and one of the analysts gave a really good. There was Michael Moore. His movie is coming out, and so he's been making the rounds all week.
Opportunist.
Sorry. So Michael Moore has been making rounds all week. And all this week I've heard like different,
opportunists,
strategists and analysts. They're talking about the Supreme Court piece. They're talking about, what Trump is saying. I also don't know if you guys have been paying attention to this trade war, which is about to make stuff in your 99-cent store be like $8.99.
Walmart is about to feel the burn.
Listen,
if you rely on almonds and almond milk, like that's about to be a situation, but that's another show. but, I've seen some analysts at least try to or attempt to make the point that sort of this constant focus on Trump and sort of blaming him as the source of everything that's bad in our politics and our policy is setting us up for failure, because there are so many other things that need to be addressed. There are so many other issues and people and institutions that are our enemy right now. And then solely placing the blame of everything that is wrong, whether it be economically, whether it be socially, whether it be about, the differences in infighting and racism, within America, all of that, solely placing it on Trump. And then what is going to happen after you get Trump out of the office?
Right.
Are we going to celebrate and it's like, yay, everything is over and everything is fixed because we got the boogeyman out of office, but then you may still not have clean water.
Pence is a boogeyman.
You may still...
Andy was also... Never mind. It's one after the other. It's boom, bad, boom, bad, boom, bad.
But in all of these instances... Right. Even if you remove Trump, let's say even if you in 2020 remove the entire Republican administration,
right,
you still may live in states where you don't have clean water.
Exactly.
You still may live in cities where your kids are going to schools that are inadequately funded. You still may have more and more people, being locked up. You still may have to deal with police departments, that are not being held accountable for killings and abuse. Like, you're still going to have these things to deal with, because it all doesn't go away with Trump.
Right.
So what do we do?
And so the thing is to, yes, focus on getting folks out of the White House and changing Congress.
Okay.
But then there's also the other things that are happening in states, in our local communities, in our cities that we have to pay attention to, because Trump isn't the answer, or removing him isn't the answer
right.
to that.
Right.
So with that, I wanted to talk about some of the other things that are happening in the states, and not bad things, right? Because sometimes we always talk about, and this is happening and we need to vote this person out of office, and this is happening and we need to go protest. Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about some other things that are actually going kind of good, or steps in the right direction.
Okay.
So let's go to California first. So in California, and I'm sure, you know, when I put this on the civic docket, I was like, Larry about to go down a whole rabbit hole with this one. But cities in California can no longer tack on extra legal fees if you get a minor code violation for your house or for something like that. And some of us in other states may feel this, right? You get a fine for $90 or for $900, but then there's like $1,100 in legal fees and all of the other stuff that's tacked on, and then makes it just compounds the issue and makes it, you know, more of a financial burden on you.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now in California, there's a new law that was enacted that says it's illegal for cities and counties to charge defendants for the legal costs to investigate, prosecute, or appeal a criminal violation of a local ordinance.
I love it. I love it. Like, this is, we saw this type of system that was basically using poverty as a way of funneling people into a prison industrial complex to make money for a city. We really saw a horrific example of this in Ferguson, right? So, and we didn't really know about this happening until after the killing of Mike Brown. But what we found there was that an average person gets a ticket, as you mentioned, a $90 ticket because something happened with this sewer. There's cracks in your sidewalk in front of your house, and you didn't get the, and I know this because I actually got a ticket because of cracks in our side house. Like, we got a notification. You don't pay the fee. That $90 bill, it increases. It already comes with additional fees that you have to pay just for getting the ticket itself. But then if there's a delay, then it may double. Then if it gets sent to court because you still haven't paid it, then the court may add additional fees, may add additional fines. And what we found in Ferguson, and in many cities across the country, is that these low-level fees were, one, heavily targeted towards predominantly Black and Brown communities. So we're not getting the same fee or fine for a crack in the sidewalk in the white community as we are in the Black community. And then once people have been, or if you get a traffic ticket and your traffic stops are only heavily monitored in your community versus a wealthier community, and what we find is that these fees, especially for these smaller municipalities, are essentially the budget builder for these municipalities. So the city of Ferguson, that municipality was essentially paying for all of its civil services by taking these exorbitant fees from the people who were least empowered to stop it. So I was super happy about this. And I would like to see, I'd like to somebody, not me, because I don't have time, but I would like somebody to do a sketch and a chart that can map out where these types of oppressive fee structures are located, and look at the correlation between who is getting fined and who is filling up the jail cells and what the relationship there is.
Yeah. Well, this actually came from NPR and a local newspaper actually did a report talking about cities in Southern California that were using private law firms to recoup some of these fines and things of that nature. And so this came from, there was a woman who had a tenant, and the tenant kept chickens. Mm. And so it was against, you know, it was a violation code or whatever to keep farm animals in, you know, in the city piece or whatever. So she got warnings and finds the things. And finally she went and she said, my only option was like to plead guilty or not guilty. And
right.
if she pleaded not guilty, then she'd have to pay for lawyers. And
right.
so she just pleaded guilty because she wasn't, you know, saying that they weren't there. She had them clean it up and go from there. And the fine was $225.
Yeah.
So she paid it. She thought it was good. But then the law firm came and it was like, yeah, you owe like $5,600.
Right.
Like, and fine was like, wait, but the ticket was.
Yeah. Yeah, and we see that. There was a woman here in New York, in Brooklyn, actually. She was accused of having not paid her water bill on a brownstone that had been in her family for nearly 100 years. And the limit for water bill payments is like $1,000 before the lien can be placed against your property. And once a lien is placed against your property, it can then technically be taken by the city.
Mm-hmm.
end of the story is the city actually was wrong in assessing this lien as against her. But had she not been connected to people who could help her advocate, she was going to be either out of her family home at 70, 80 years old and or saddled with fees that, one, weren't even properly attributed to her, but two, were unaffordable. So I think kudos to NPR, kudos to this local media outlet that focused in on this issue, but this is the way journalism should be used, right? Identifying those issues that need this type of sunlight on them so that policy can actually change.
Mm-hmm. Well, moving over to San Francisco. So staying in California, London Breed, who's the new mayor there.
First black woman.
Yes.
Love her.
There's a court order now, something that she introduced legislation and stuff before, that would allow about 20,000 people to be forgiven of fees. These are fees that you pay after you are released from prison. Mm-hmm. And they're supposed to go to, it's criminal justice fees or fines or things like that. I don't know if you're familiar with it. And it was about $32 million. And so the issue is that people would be released from jail, but then you have to pay these fees, and then you're trying to get a job and trying to get your life together, June. But then you also have these fees to pay. And so it's like, you got to pay these fees, but now I'm out and I need to feed my kids, or like at least get, you know, rent. And it's hard enough getting a job anyway with this record. And so, you know, this is 20,000 people that will not have their wages garnished. Mm-hmm. To make this happen. I mean, we talk about, I mean, I see all the time in the tweets where people talk about being poor is expensive, mm-hmm. or being marginalized is expensive, mm-hmm. and all of these additional things that fees and things that are tacked on that you have to pay. But Larie, these are a step in the right direction, or is this taking away from, you know, the sentence that people are supposed to do?
No, personally, the sentence is done. They serve their time. And if they are coming from communities, as many of them are, that are overly policed and policed through a racist paradigm, then part of them being in jail anyway is attributable to racism and to harm that comes from being really policed in a way that is in keeping with the white supremacist framework for justice. So for me, if you are coming out of prison or jail having served your time, and then I think it was with 21,000 people and $32 million, it's like $1,500 a piece, right?
Wow.
I'm thinking about people who have to find a place to live, which costs money. People who have to feed themselves and or family members, which costs money. I'm thinking about people who are coming out of prison or jail who want to do better and want to embrace a lifestyle that is going to allow them to make better choices, and you're already saddled with a $1,500 debt. A few weeks ago on the Karen Hunter Show, we were talking about the fact that most Americans couldn't come up with $1,000 in an emergency if they needed it. So the fact that these community members who are the least empowered to pay this type of fine are then saddled with this fee after having to navigate what's going to happen to their job opportunities and potential to access social resources because they are just formerly incarcerated. To me, if you want to reduce recidivism, we could start by removing the $1,500 bill that you essentially get for finally earning your freedom.
Well, they're saying that the argument, I guess, when they put these fees into place was that they were supposed to offset, or you're supposed to recoup costs for prosecuting them in the first place. So they use an example, you know, of person, he gets out of jail, he has a felony, yes, but then he has a $135 booking fee he has to pay back, a $240 restitution fee, and then $1,800 for probation fee, and sort of all that stuff. So it's supposed to be like money that's supposed to go back to incarcerate, like, but that's not what it was actually doing.
Mm-mm. And so, if we had a guaranteed income, which we've discussed before, perhaps this might be a different framework. But because these are folks who are typically coming from worse employment opportunities, and now even far worse employment opportunities because of their stint in prison, these aren't the people who can pay that cost. So if you're going to have this type of structure where the bail and fee has to be recouped, where the processing fee has to, then you need to fix your tax structure so that the people who are already paying into the system so that your city can run and operate itself will have these costs also built in, so that it actually gets paid, because people weren't even paying it.
Well, yeah, that was the issue, is that they found out, the treasurer and the tax collector figured out like 80% of the bills weren't being paid in the first place.
I'm shocked that that is the case, that poor people can't pay $1,500 to the jailer who just let them out. I'm shocked. This is my shocked
face. They go back
face.
To jail. They keep going back to jail because debtor's prison is real.
Right.
I don't care what they say on paper, it's real.
It
this is.
Is
how they backdoor you into your debts.
That's
into,
right.
Oh, it's a felony. Now you go to jail.
That's right.
Well, all right, moving on to Baltimore. I'm actually excited about this.
Yeah.
Because I want to do a whole show on public utilities.
Mm.
You mean like the railroad and like the electric company?
You talk, not Monopoly.
Oh, I'm just saying.
I'm talking about.
I was with it with the electric company, but then I had to think the railroad.
Right, it was like the railroad. No, we're not talking about Monopoly. But yes, the electric company, talking about how we get water, how we get gas, how we get like how that's funded. And have you ever walked in Best Buy or another place and they're like, do you want to pay less for your electricity and how it's delivered?
Mm, yeah.
And then I went down the rabbit hole one day to figure out how your electricity and your gas actually gets delivered and sort of all of the legislation and things that are affected by that. Y'all. Okay, we're going to have a whole nother show because I went down the rabbit hole.
Yeah.
This is like going down the rabbit hole of trash, which, by the way, that show is coming. I'm just looking for an expert on trash to talk about this with me. Okay, but in Baltimore, legislators in Baltimore have taken steps to approve a resolution. I think they already approved the resolution now as of, you know, of this day, that would ban the privatization of water.
Mm. Good for them.
So the resolution would amend their charter to bar any sale of Baltimore water and sewer systems. And that now it goes on to the ballot in November. This will be a ballot amendment in November. Remember, we talk about paying attention to not only candidates that are running,
right,
but then ballot issues that may be on the ballot. So it's important to know what is on your ballot come November, because there also may be ballot questions for your local, for your city, for your town, or for your state. So it's important. We talked about in Florida, right? There's going to be a ballot question about whether or not the state wants to restore voting rights to those who were formerly incarcerated.
Yep.
So that's one ballot initiative.
Mm-hmm.
So now with this, it would be on the citywide ballot.
Mm-hmm.
Because it passed the city council, it's going to be on the ballot, and the public would have to approve. Yeah, we don't want to sell. We don't want to have privately owned sewer and water companies.
Because that could be bad if it goes bad.
I'm
right?
almost like, 50. It has never gone
it's
good. It starts off looking good
great.
In the beginning, and then it takes a turn, and then everybody's paying more money, and no one's responsible. So
right.
good for them.
Kind of like Flint,
get out and vote, people.
It's on the
ballot.
Yeah, and I think that's important. I know you highlighted this, and without going down my own rabbit hole, like, it is important. So when we say go vote, is again not just for the candidates, but you might want to see if you can pull your ballot ahead of time so you can read what the initiative says. It can be you don't may not have a whole lot of time in your booth, but you need to know if I hit yes, that means I get publicly owned water. If I say no, that means a company that may or may not like me and my people is going to control my access to water. You need to know that. And if you're in Florida, if I vote yes, this means 1.6 million additional people of color are going to get the right to vote back. If I don't show up at all, they will continue to not be able to engage civically. So again, community control and being in control of our destiny collectively comes in many shapes and forms.
Mm-hmm.
Vote, like literally going to the voting booth, is like the least taxing.
But look at that stuff early, because sometimes yes is equal no and no equal yes.
That's right.
So just read it early.
That's
Get
right.
it early.
Understand the language. And if you don't know what the language is actually asking, because many times these referendum or ballot initiatives are not necessarily written in language for the people to understand.
Wasn't it back in the day, California 187 or something?
Jesus.
Yes was no and no was yes or something.
It
weird?
Caused much confusion.
Okay, I'm
so
just saying.
So be aware. Pull those ballots early. Find
early.
Out what those referendums are
Often.
Early. Because Baltimore, y'all could be really up that creek, like dealing with Flint, Michigan levels of poisoned water should this go bad. Because it could.
Well, the other thing is that there are also rising costs of our utility, you know, public
right.
utilities
mm-hmm.
as well. And particularly, you may have seen cases in which people are unable to pay their water bills and things,
yep.
you know, people, whole communities or whole blocks or, you know, are shut off because they have such high water bills.
Right.
And Atlanta, I think, New Orleans, the cost of water has increased, but then service decreased
right.
when they privatized, you know, the water utility.
Right.
Right. So these are all, you know, overall America's infrastructure in general is not that great.
Trash.
It's trash.
We're falling apart, and that includes not only roads, bridges, subways, New York City.
Mm. It was raining in them,
but also things like our public utilities. And we're doing all of this building. People, and particularly in other places like New York City, Baltimore, and all DC, it's all this great building. We're building great towers and market rate rent and sort of all those things. But you're building it on top of aging infrastructure.
We're not talking about that right now, Eljoy. We need big, pretty buildings.
With lots of wealthy people living in it.
And glass. Yeah. Lots of glass.
Lots of glass in brownstone neighborhoods.
And no okay, poor but then people. When your toilet right. is bubbling up in your nice, pretty house.
Yell at the super.
That's his job.
Because here's the thing. In 6 months from now, if Baltimore privatizes, y'all should see Eljoy's face right now. 6 months from now, if Baltimore privatizes the water because not enough people went to the voting booth where they could influence that decision, and then Big Mama get her water cut off, and then her neighbor and the five neighbors down there don't get water because of this initiative, because privatization decreased the services, raised the prices. They don't be complaining, talking about why.
Oh, they're going to want to rally.
They're going to want to rally. But you know what? It's easier
Al
to do than a rally.
Come down. Listen. The NAACP.
What's the NAACP doing about this?
They're
going to want to
get a protest song, a march.
When
but you know what you could
march?
Do?
What's going on?
You know what you could do to save you a lot? Because that's a whole lot of effort, time, and energy. You know what you could
but
do?
But that's what I want.
You could go vote in November. To privatize, to keep your water
no
in the
fun.
Hands of your
people. We're gonna have a whole show on this because I need us to understand why sort of the privatization. And people think, I think privatization of everything is bad. Maybe not, but the track record hasn't been that good.
Right.
So
that's all I
we
can
come
go by.
Back. When we come back, we're going to talk more about this election cycle. I teased it in the beginning. I want to talk about losing June.
Okay.
I want to talk about losing when we come back here on Sunday Civics on Sirius XM Channel 126.
All the wahala, all the problems, all the things that you think that you must do to start in this world. Like when the teacher, schoolboy and schoolgirl come together. Who is the teacher?
All right, welcome back to Sunday Civics here this Sunday morning. I'm your host, Eljoy Williams. And we're going to talk this morning just briefly about losing. The primary season is over, like I said, and while all across the country we're celebrating the winners, today I want to focus on those who may lost, those of you who may supported candidates who lost. As some of you may know, over the past few months I've been working for Cynthia Nixon, who waged a primary challenge against Andrew Cuomo here in New York State in the Democratic primary. The primary election just happened and we lost. And unfortunately, most elections are winner take all in our system. And in elections in general, it's become a sport where we sometimes make the candidates and their supporters feel like the issues they raised during their campaigns weren't valuable or important. During the last presidential primary, for instance, and it's no secret that I was heavily critical of Bernie Sanders and his use of the Democratic Party as a vehicle for his presidential bid, but his candidacy brought an enormous amount of attention to issues that millions of people in this country wanted to hear. And I'm not sure those issues would have been a major part of the 2016 presidential cycle without his candidacy and the energy from his supporters. But just because you or your candidate lost, it doesn't mean you take your toys and go home. It's important to evaluate what impact your candidacy had on the campaign cycle. And because of your campaign, what issues or policies were lifted up that might not have otherwise been discussed. So here's a couple of questions to ask yourself. Did your campaign reflect your political values? If you care about campaign finance reform, how did you raise money for your campaign? Did you resist the temptation to take any money from corporate donations? Did you not take things from LLCs? Did you have patterns and practice put in place in your overall campaign that would be reflective of the representative you wanted to be or the office you wanted to represent? So maybe you didn't take corporate money. Maybe your staff and the consultants that you hired on the campaign were inclusive and diverse as much as your district. Perhaps you wanted, as a candidate, you wanted to see candidates and campaigns actually get out in the community and have more conversations. Were you able to do that? Second question to ask yourself, did your campaign move the policy issues you care about? Right. So if you ran on for school board to talk more about equity in education funding, did you run for district attorney talking about reforming the criminal justice system? Or did you run for city council or state legislature or something like that? And your whole focus was on repairing infrastructure, the subway in New York City. How did those issues advance during the campaign? Are they now the topic of discussion? Is every editorial board discussing these topics? Are there town halls? Shoot, is the incumbent now having a listening tour on the topic? Those are things that you want to include in your evaluation on how successful your campaign was. Third thing to ask yourself, did your campaign engage more people in the process? Mm-hmm. Now, this is an important one because sometimes the candidates that emerge during an election cycle are often reflective of people who have felt ignored, betrayed by the incumbent or someone else, or their issue may have never been discussed in the context of an election cycle. Did your campaign actually raise them up and bring value to the issues and also to the people that have been marginalized in that district or in that community? That's a real win for your campaign, even if at the end of the day, someone else got more votes than you.
Indeed.
The last question I would say, and you know, I'm sure there are other questions that you can ask yourself, but how did your candidacy affect the power structure? Now, this is important. This is important because yes, someone else, and maybe the incumbent won, maybe, you know, a different person in a different party, maybe the same person that's been winning for 25 years won the election. But how did your candidacy and the campaign have an effect on the power structure? Did it force them to pay attention to a part of the district that has not been heard and not been engaged in the process? Did it force the incumbent to have to campaign and answer to people that they had never talked to before? Shoot, did they hold more press conferences and talk to more community papers and editorial boards? Did you make them have to spend more money and engage in the overall election process and not act as if it, you know, this was just taken for granted that they would become the elected, would retain the elected position? All of these questions are valuable things that you need to ask yourself, right? And I think at the end of the day, after you lose an election, you have to think about these things. It may be in, you know, with a bottle at the bar. It may be in the silence of your own home. Or it may be among your supporters and sort of doing that evaluation like you would do, right? Put your paper on the wall. What worked? What didn't work? You know, what can we do better? So what do you do after you lose an election?
Correct.
Here's my advice. You get back to work and run again, June.
Oh, okay.
Exactly.
Even
right.
If you are crying, June.
Even if you are crying.
Yeah, you work with
because
them tears.
Here's the thing. Do you still care about equity in education
exactly.
funding?
Exactly.
Do you still care about reforming our justice system?
Yes.
You still believe we ought to have campaign finance reform, right? Mm-hmm. And there are still ways to fight for all of those things and more. Now, if you're the candidate, you may have lost a congressional race, but you may run for state treasurer next cycle. You may have run for governor this cycle and lost, but you may run again in 4 years. So don't take your toys
or
and go
for mayor.
Home. Or for mayor, yes.
So
don't take your toys and go home. Go home, mourn your loss, evaluate your campaign, but come back swinging. Because remember, you go home, that means you go back to your supporters. That means you go back to the people
That's right.
who gave you money. You go back to those institutions who supported you, who stepped out on faith and supported your candidacy, supported the political values, supported those issues, supported you to be the flag bearer for all of those issues. And so, yes, you go home. Yes, you mourn the loss. Yes, you evaluate what you did right, what you want to do differently if you decide to run again, or give that information to the next person who will run. And remember, also, lots of people lose elections. Hell, one quarter of presidents lost an election before they actually ran and won the presidency. Lyndon Johnson ran a special election and lost. Richard Nixon lost narrowly to JFK. Mm-hmm. Barack Obama got his behind whooped by Bobby Rush right. when he ran against him the first time, and then he resulted in being our president. So a loss may not be the end all be all, but you do need to evaluate. You do need to come back swinging. Don't take your toys and go home. Mm. We'll be right back.
Sounds good. My name is Joyce Johnson, and my first civic action goes back about 30 years. And it was probably, I'll start to get agitated by it. The thought of losing a home. I live on the Upper West Side, and I lived in the Mitchellama. My aunt left and, you know, went back to South Carolina and said, I live in a 2-bedroom, bath and a half. Would you like to take this apartment over? And I said, absolutely. I was living down on 40th Street, stayed in this Mitchellama, became a part of the community, and then all of a sudden realized that this Mitchellama was part of a 25-year program of affordability. As time ticked on, that window of 25 years was ending, and there was no guarantee that this Mitchellama program, statewide program, over 500,000 apartments, affordable housing, was part of the urban redevelopment, West Side and all parts around the state, was then subject to being unauthorized by the state assembly. And I'm saying the state assembly, our Senate, and the governor. And for years, I was started hyperventilating because it was the best deal in the that I'll ever know. And just the thought of losing one's home and the affordability part after I had made roots in community was the most unsettling. I started then on the West Side with marches and rallies, went to Albany each and every year with the authorization or non-authorization of the program. Every year that, you know, we would go to Albany and it said, well, wait, you know, it's getting better and we're sure that this, we can make it happen. Well, it never did. And that was the most frustrating experience for me. Boots on the ground, marches and rallies. I have laid down on the carpet in the governor's office, all believing what was right. We the people are here to petition those who have been elected to serve us and our interests, you know, to do this right thing by affordability. It never happened. And so that was the first really big civic action I've ever done. And it was one that I lost and we the people lost. But that loss, as we've been talking about before, you simply get up and stay with it. Because sadly, there have been many others since then. But that was the first.
All's my life I has to fight, nigga. All's my life I. Hard times like, yeah. Bad trips like, yeah. Nazareth, I'm fucked up, homie, you fucked up. But if God got us, then we gon' be all right.
Nigga, we gon' be all right.
All right, we gon' be all right, y'all.
Hey, that was rough.
You may have lost. You may have volunteered on a campaign. You may have donated to a campaign and the candidate lost. But we're going to be all right. Joining us to continue this conversation is a dear friend of mine. We serve on the board together of Higher Heights. Joyce Johnson, who comes from a long line of proud activists who believed in public service. And Joyce, she's a graduate of Howard University with a degree in microbiology.
Oh, wow. Shout out, scientist.
Shout out to the scientist. And left her, you know, very comfortable job in corporate America.
Sure did.
to work in public service. And that's how I met her. You had, you know, 17 years in corporate America and then left to do public service. You've ran for office. You've worked in public service for the borough president's office.
The controller. Yeah.
And so thank you very much. Joining Sunday Civics is
Love
Joyce
it.
Johnson.
Thank you. A privilege. Proud to be with you.
Good morning.
I wish the audience could have heard the snippets we were getting on the break.
Well, you know, I have to yell at y'all because y'all be talking to the people we interviewing. I'm like, save it for the show.
You need so that we on should sit here in uncomfortable silence.
Oh, I can't man. Do that.
I'm saying, y'all, okay. We gotta save it for the show. You can't just like, you know, take all the gems and then we'll forget everything for the people who are listening. Mm. Anyway,
okay.
So Joyce is joining us not only because of her brilliance and because we serve together, but she happens to know something about running and losing but still winning.
Mm. Exactly.
And so Joyce, I set up in the introduction talking about the questions you ask yourself after you run for office. Are those some of the questions you've asked yourself?
Absolutely. There's always the aftermath, you know, what went well, what could have been much better, what can you do the next time? And I'm always a next time person. And I'll tell you how this journey started. Yes, I was at Seagram and I was director of Equal Employment Opportunity for the corporation nationally. I mean, living a great life and whatnot, that corporate life. And it was during the era of Reagan Bush when I saw a dismantling of affirmative action. Mm. And certainly my job, director of Equal Employment Opportunity, that was impacted. And I said that one day I am going to Congress to put teeth in legislation. That simple statement began the journey, but it's in the aftermath of what was while watching my parents as public servants, community activists, and what they had done. And I said, it's time for me to leave this glory and go to where there's real activity, real promise of something different for we the people. And another piece of it, and it was never going to happen, my father and I were out drinking one night. He was a council member in Poughkeepsie. And of course, we were drinking because I worked for Seagram. But long story short, my dad said to me, I think you're becoming a Republican. And what he meant by that was my life was so comfortable. I was not engaged in community and civic. I was flying around the country for Seagram. Mm. And that really, in my family, to be said that I think you're becoming a Republican, it doesn't get much worse than that. You can't use a curse word that's worse in my family. And that and that started the journey. And so the move to public office, the journey work. But what was really very interesting to me is that I didn't realize that there was a system. Equal employment opportunity for me always meant let the best and brightest come forward. That is not necessarily the case in our public life. Mm. You know, so often in campaigns, the deck is absolutely stacked against you. Mm. You know, there is an establishment that may have picks. You think there's an open race, and before the race is called, you know, the person who's been anointed before you know it has every endorsement that is. What it has done, except for this current period, is to tamp down the aspirations and want of community and going up the line to do better for those of us who really just wanted to do, which was my journey. I said, dismantling affirmative action, I'm going to Congress one day. Mm. But in this, Joy, I've run 6 times. I have never used the word loss. Mm. Each and every race I have run, I have been a better person personally. The people who believed me heard something different. Mm. You know, I gained so much. And what I have in these campaigns, regardless of the outcome on the election night, I was faced with people that had been so turned off by the electoral process. I can't tell you how many times I've been indicted. Like, you're all the same. The only time I see you is when there is an election. And that was a real heartbreak in our communities in particular, when we need people energized. The vision of me for public life in New York City happened to have come from watching Adam Clayton Powell. Mm. I was a little girl from Poughkeepsie, New York, but whenever there was talk about Harlem politics, there was always tape video of Adam Clayton Powell. You could see him in the streets, a following, dynamic. We have lost, and so that was the picture of activism. Mm. And he could call, he could turn on a dime. He could make a statement, come out to the corner of 125th and whatever, and there would be thousands of people wow. because he had their back. Mm-hmm. You call the politicians today, call and they, and what we have, your regular posse. You know, Democratic district leaders, as I was one. And this is not to indict the system, per se. And then again, it is to indict, because it is supposed to be about we the people and all the people, and not just your friends and family, your posse, your political club. And understand, I went through all of that. But we are in the position now where there is that we the people, when we need them to vote, they're not there. They are not there. There are over 600,000 African Americans in the state of New York who are eligible to vote and not registered. Imagine if we were that empowered, we could impact any governor's race, any senator's race, any controller's race, or whatever. And so when our communities don't get what we think they need, it's a function of what? Electoral power. You know, the only thing politicians are scared of are people who vote. And when you can rely on a good population not voting, you can turn to someone else who says, who has that power and is using it. So that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
I'm all right. I like it. I like that story.
I feel like between what you just said and some of the comments and questions you asked us to think about earlier, Joy, I feel like what we're really saying is that the win of the position is not the win.
That's exactly right.
The win is centering the issues and the needs of the community, elevating their engagement with these issues. And as we were saying during the break, now I think the population in New York City and New York State as a result of this most recent gubernatorial campaign has an elevated expectation about, you know, wow, there can be a Black maternal health policy.
Yes.
Who knew? Yes. Wow, there can be a culturally responsive education policy. Who knew? And for disempowered communities who aren't used to having our issues truly spoken to in any meaningful way, once you see it happen, now our expectations are that much greater.
Exactly.
So the next time around, we're going to be asking elected officials or people who are running for office, what's your position on Black maternal health?
And accountability.
And accountability.
We put you in, we'll take you out.
Right. That's exactly
that's the numbers in.
And I think that's important. And, you know, I guess we have to have a separate show, June and Marie, talking about the difference between pandering and also actually engagement and speaking to issues.
Indeed.
Yes.
Because a lot of the times people feel that, you know, candidates come to you and because they have a position or a policy piece on Black maternal health, oh, you're just pandering to Black women. It's just like, well, damn, I damned if I do and I damned if I don't. Because if I didn't have one, you'd be like, Black women are dying.
What do you care?
Do about
how
it?
Many
do
Black women in labor have you helped today?
Right.
But so I think, like, when I think of pandering, I think I haven't seen you since the last election. You showed up at my church to shake hands and take pictures.
That's pandering.
There's a pander. But a well-thought-out policy and platform that looks at an issue critically, or engaged conversation that looks critically at an issue that's of vital importance to the people, that's engagement. And we have to be able to call a thing and be sophisticated enough in our civic engagement that we can distinguish between a pander
Indeed.
And a policy.
That's a great comment.
Yes.
Great comment. And
I think that's something, but that comes also with maturity in civic life.
Yes.
It does.
Right? Because we are taught that, you know, the engagement is, or someone doing a good job as an elected official, what individuals evaluate who that good elected official is, is, oh, he comes to my church every Thanksgiving and gives us turkeys. And so that equates my, you know, me giving you my vote.
Right.
Or you may say, oh, well, I see them on TV all the time, or I see them at the protests every time. I see them, so they must be doing something. Rather than, well, what are they actually doing? Like, where are their votes based upon? What have they invested in and things of that nature? So that comes with civic maturity, and it's part of the reason why we do this show. Is for you to move from being civically immature and thinking that because someone shows up with a turkey that they deserve your vote, or if they are addressing, you know, doing the embodiment of what their position is supposed to do, which is representing you. So if all you want for your council member, for your legislature, is for them to show up at church and give you a turkey every Thanksgiving, that's cool.
Carry on.
That, I mean, that is what you are voting for, right? Because that is what, that is all that you expect. That is all that you want from your elected official. Mm-hmm. But if you want more, once you learn what they are supposed to be providing, once you know that they are supposed to be deciding where your tax dollars go, once you know that they are supposed to be making sure that there is equity in your child's school funding, mm-hmm. once you know all of that stuff, you can't go back.
Right.
You can't go back.
Right.
And I'll say that I can no longer handle the people who are immature.
Mm. Really?
And I can't, for this reason. There was a time, and this is, I'm dating myself. It was third grade when my teacher had us do the state of New York, 62 counties, 32. We knew the government structure, the economic structure, and all of this. Throughout high school and in general, going to the NAACP, the Girl Scouts and all, we knew about voting, the importance of it. Hmm. And certainly I came up during an era of watching the civil rights movement and what that meant in terms of black folks. And so we have so much, everybody has skin in the game. And so a lot of it, I think, if we have not my generation, but future generations have not carried on this notion of, and you hear of old school black folks said, what? I'm afraid not to vote. My hand to God, I have never missed a vote in my life. Mm. I've had to hold my nose sometimes, but it's been so embedded in me that you have that obligation. What is it? We the people, by the people, for the people, only if the people will vote. Mm. And that one vote, and to be smart about that vote, to your point, to be smart about that vote is mandatory to me of all of us. Mm. It really, really is. The great equalizer in this country to me is your vote. You stay, the four of us, you know, you stay home and the three of us are conspiring against your interests because you haven't weighed in on that interest. Mm. So it's not condemning. What I'm saying is we need to be re-educated, and it starts with every generation. You'll pass it on to him.
Yeah.
I dare my grandkids not to vote. I ask, did you vote? Mm. You can be kicked out of the house. You know, I've got one grandson who lives on the sofa. I hope he doesn't hear the story. He lives on the sofa. But last Thursday, he got himself up. I said, are you going to vote today? And I mean, he was shaking. Oh, yes. I said, okay. You know, you will be put out, you'll be put off the sofa and go find another place to live, which he does anyway.
Well, I mean, all of that to say, it's, you know, your vote along with your voice is important.
Yes.
And so it's not enough just to, you know, go to the booth and go home and I'll come back, you know, next 4 years or even next election. But it's also adding your voice to this, right? Because the people that you send to represent you are representatives. Mm. And so just like the story I tell here all the time about being with my then council member, Al Vann, someone comes up to him and says, I only see you on election time. And then the council member said, I only see you on election time too.
Exactly. Good point.
Also being involved in the process, because how do people know how to represent you if you don't tell them what your interests are?
Yeah.
So, Joyce, thank you so very much for joining us.
My pleasure, for sharing your story.
Final closeout. What advice? You know, there are people listening who, you know, may have ran for a district seat this cycle, may have run their first time because people are active and engaged. And you say you ran six times.
Yes, I did.
So what advice, you know, as you're counseling, and I know, you know, you join with me in counseling and encouraging women all across the country to run for office. But for, you know, though, anyone who is listening, no matter gender identity, who may have lost this cycle, what advice do you give them for going forward?
If you have the passion for the work, you are obligated to stay with it. Mm. There are no guarantees. You mentioned in every election, someone wins and someone loses. It doesn't happen. You know, you mentioned it early on in the program, LBJ, you mentioned Nixon, and in every election, someone is the winner and someone is not the winner that time. There could be another time you stay at it. You know, this is a journey, and there are no guarantees about anything. But it's not always the winning. It's, to your point, the advancement of the issues, the competition. You know, if you're in the race, then the incumbent or your opponent is better by your being in the race, and vice versa. and all in the public's interest. Stay with it. There is nothing. That's why I say to you, I have never won a race, but I have never lost either, by virtue of the experience, the knowledge, and the people who supported me had a voice for that moment. And so stay with it.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Joyce. June. Woo. And Laree.
Yes, ma'am.
Has this been, have you, you know, learned a little something?
I'm excited.
Okay.
I want to run for something now. I'm coming for Teresa Freeman's seat. I'm going to do it.
All right.
All right now.
All right now.
All right. Well, thanks everyone for listening. We'll be back next week with new shows, all new shows of Sunday Civics here on Sirius XM Urban View, Channel 126. I am your host, Eljoy Williams, and your civics teacher.
Yes, you
can tweet
there you go.
At me at Eljoy Williams. You can also visit the website, sundaycivics.org, to see all of the videos and show notes and more information. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you next Sunday.